So, hi, my name is Aleksandra Walczak, and this is what I will be talking about today. This is work done with Michael Desai, Josh Plotkin, and a graduate student at Harvard, Laura Nicolaisen. And we were generally interested in the effect of selection on linked sites. Before I talk what I'm going to talk about, I'd just like to tell you briefly that there's other things I'm interested in, which have to do with characterizing antibody diversity and figuring out statistical descriptions from which we can learn something about how the immune system evolves to encounter new pathogens. So if you'd like to talk to me or Thierry Morat, who's also here, who we've worked on this together on, I'd be happy to. But now back to selection. So, I mean, I think the motivation for this is generally clear, but I'll still sort of go through it, that we're interested in generally understanding evolutionary processes, and we'd like to understand how selection alters the patterns of genetic variation. And currently what people do is they look at data, they compare to neutral models, or in some cases, models with weak selection, those are sort of the null models, and they see what's wrong. Why doesn't the statistics that they calculate from data agree with the predictions of these null models? And there's, of course, many reasons you can think of, many complications. I'll talk about them I'll mention them again briefly. So our goal was basically to add to this list of null models a null model with selection, so that then we can compare, see what our null model of selection gives us, and then we can figure out whether the system is selected upon or not, or maybe there's other things going on, such as the effects of demography, geography, and so on. And so our long-term goal is really to be able to look at data and look at the variation that exists in the data and try and say something, or first of all, try and figure out whether it's selection is acting there, but also, or there's other things like I mentioned, demography. But then also, if we figure out this is, for example, a mostly selective regime, can we actually say something more about this selection? And so, because these null models would give us actually concrete expectations and not just a comparison to a null model where you can say, okay, there is selection or there is no selection. So I'd like to make two points which I think are pretty obvious to this audience, but just to say them. So if we look at specific mutations, we can calculate the fate of each mutant forward in time, and although each mutation arises and then goes extinct, so the mutations themselves are not in steady state, but there is a steady state distribution of mutant frequencies, as we know, because Stefan mentioned them and we've been talking about them a lot. So we'll be relying on these observations. And the other thing is I'll be talking about linked sites, so there will be no recombination. In that sense, the sites are fully linked, everything is pretty simple. Okay, so, and one of the goals and the framework we've developed that I'll try and present is that we know that a null model that exists when there is, or the way we can think about this problem, if there is no selection, we can think about coalescence theory and look at the individuals we observe and ask who their ancestors were. And if the system is neutral and there's no other complications, no selection, recombination, or geography, then we can in principle infer a common ancestor. And then we can, the coalescence theory basically gives us a framework for thinking about the system where we build a tree and then sprinkle neutral mutations on top of it. So our goal here and what I'll try to present is an approach we have been thinking about to extend to build a similar framework for mutation. And so then when we do look at data, we can try and see whether the data we're saying is consistent with an evolutionary process that would lead to it, and we can think about it in terms of coalescence framework. Okay, so that's generally the philosophy and motivation. So the way we thought about this model is that we have some distribution, some fitness distribution, where individuals can mutate and lose fitness, and I guess I haven't said this yet, but we are going to talk only about deleterious mutations. So by acquiring a mutation, an individual loses, it becomes less fit, and then that individual gets selected upon, and as a result of balance of the mutation and selection, this results in a steady state distribution. In the model, we'll be considering each mutation decreases the fitness by one. So again, this is a picture where we have the most fit class with zero mutations, and then each class is less fit and selection acts upon it. And so by the elements of the model, as I said, are deleterious mutations which occur at the, so we have a steady state distribution which results from the mutation selection balance, and I will call that H of K. So H of K is the probability, is basically the frequency of each fitness class. So then a deleterious mutation occurs proportionally to the occupation of that given fitness class, and then selection acts with a selection coefficient proportional to that fitness class, which we scale by the mean of this distribution, that's K average. So we have deleterious mutations coming in from a less fitness class, going out into, coming in from the more fit class, going out into the less fit class, and then selection acting on it. And we can solve this equation for steady state, and we see it's a Poisson distribution with a mean UD over S. So the mid class has fitness UD over S, which is the selection between deleterious mutations and selection.
So this is just a quasi-species, right, so far, right? So there's some error classes and...
So this is where I think things get a bit more complicated.
But finite, is there a finite population set in these eyes in your discussion here? Not yet.
Not yet. I mean, yeah.
Does this change?
It's not.
Yeah. I mean, it will change, but I think.
So it's the infinite population size limit.
So what we will be assuming is infinite, and actually,
the only question is whether you have to worry about the ratchet.
I think the answer is yes, we do have to worry about the ratchet, but we are not going to worry about the ratchet. Okay. So there will be, if you pay close attention, you will notice the ratchet.
So pay close
attention. And I'll be happy to discuss the ratchet towards the end. But as you see, I feel slightly nervous about it. And the ratchet is what has led us to what Michael and I and Boris and the other Michael are sort of currently obsessed about. But let's go on. So we have this steady state distribution, and we divided individuals according to fitness, but so we're assuming a model where a mutation, it's an infinite site model. So each mutation creates a new lineage, a new allele. And so within each fitness class, within each fitness class, not all individuals are identical. And so we depict this by using different colors. Each color is one allele, one lineage, all the individuals in one color are genetically the same. However, you can imagine getting different, a given fitness in different ways. And in our model, the way that happens is every time a mutation happens, a new lineage is started. And then that lineage can grow or die, but each mutation creates a new lineage. So
this is then our finite population.
Yeah.
Because you always start with one individual.
No, we start with a
fraction of, with a fraction.
With some number of individuals.
No, but it is right that it's a. We're sort of assuming a weird thing here. There's an infinite population size shape of the fitness distribution. But now when we consider the lineage structure, we're still assuming that infinite n shape of the distribution, but the lineage structure will depend on the population size.
Yeah.
So the fitness doesn't depend only on the number of mutations. So
it doesn't depend it does. Only on
no,
the
I'm
number.
I'm asking. Because,
it does, right?
It does. Yeah.
Each mutation, only the number of mutations is important for determining fitness, correct?
No, I mean, selection also, I mean, I don't understand the question. What do you mean that it only depends on the number of
In mutations? Both of the models, the fitness depends only on the number of mutations.
The fitness, yes. You know, the fitness does depend only on the number of mutations.
But how come you have these classes with...
All the individuals in the given bin have the same number of mutations, but there's different mutations, so they're different clones.
The problem is that the genome has an infinite size, so in principle it would be really hard to see how that's a problem.
So there is an assumption
that many individuals with exactly the same mutations at the same locus.
It's not the same.
No,
the same number.
No, it's not at the same locus. It's many, forget it, you don't think about loci here. You just think, you say you sequence things and you count. How many individuals have 5 mutations? You put them in this class. How many individuals have 4 mutations? You put them in this class. And each class, all you care is the number of mutations. Then within a class, you know that all the individuals that had 4 mutations, you have,
That's my point. Now, how do you distinguish the colors within the class?
Then they're exactly the same. You align them and you say these are the same mutations. That's it. Okay. I wanted to say something else, but now I forgot. So it'll probably come back. this is sort of making the same point that you can also include into the model. So before, each lineage is created by a deleterious mutation coming from a fitter class, but a new lineage can also be created by a neutral mutation within the same class. So that will, that's another source of diversity. And then the selection, the individuals in each class keep track, are effectively selected upon. So this is the basic introduction of the model. And I guess we just talked about that all we're keeping track of is counting on how many mutations an individual has. And so I think before we go on, one interesting thing to notice is that if you look at the effective selection coefficient, and let's forget about the neutral mutations for a minute, then each other class has an effective, the effective selection coefficient is always negative. So that means that each other class is constantly receiving new individuals due to mutations, and these individuals in that class must die out to contain this steady state balance. Okay, I think what I wanted to actually you put an accent on with respect to your question, is that we're going to be considering steady state all throughout. So I don't really care how this distribution got here. I'm just going to make the statement that it will be maintained because individuals are selected upon and individuals constantly mutate from the most fit class and from the class it's upstream. So we do see this distribution and
But that means also that the statement that they're only okay, so the mutations are only deleterious, but you have sort of in these more favored in the lower error class an effective positive selection.
No. You always yes?
But if you keep the population size constant, you sort of so you make your 0 point of selection.
No, right, okay. This is the picture with selection acting like that.
I mean, the effective selection pressure includes both the actual selection pressure, which is favoring the guys above the average, but it also includes the fact that each lineage is losing individuals due to mutations that found, you know, further lineages. Right?
That's why there's minus UN, not the
AD.
Why there's minus UD and a minus UN. And it's those terms that ensure that each class has a negative pressure, which has to be the case, as Alex is saying.
Yeah. So, but all that means is that there's a constant turnover of things, that nothing really stagnates in any of the class, and only, so if you didn't have mutual mutations, the zero class would drift mutually. However, if you do have mutual mutations, even the neutral class has an effective negative selection pressure, which means things get taken out of it because the neutral mutations replenish that class. So you have some action everywhere. So now we have this distribution and we have a description where we're looking at lineages within the distribution of fitnesses. And in order to continue, we have to agree these two approaches. So we know basically that if we look at all the individuals in a given frequency class, so each lineage has a certain certain frequency, so basically how much of this chart it takes up. If we sum over all these lineages, so if we average, if we sum over all the lineages, we have to get back the frequency of seeing a given fitness class. And in order to be able to do that, well, we need some description of saying what is the frequency of a given lineage within a given frequency class. So we need to say what is the probability of seeing a given allele, an allele with a given frequency in a given fitness class. And to do that, we're going to use something called the Poisson random field, which is shown here, which gives exactly the probability of seeing an allele with a given frequency. And I'm going to, at the risk of starting a discussion, I'm going to talk a bit more about this. But so for now, let's just say we have an expression that gives us the probability of seeing a lineage with a given frequency in the presence of selection, of effective selection, which comes in here, giving that mutations come in and out of, well, actually here come into that, come out of that class with a given mutation rate. And so if we have now a probability of seeing a lineage with a given frequency, then we can, then as I mentioned, to agree this picture of having a steady state coming from the mutation selection balance, we have to agree that with having the distribution of fitness classes. So if we integrate over all the frequencies weighted by the probability of seeing the frequency, we should get back the probability of seeing a given fitness class. And so this is the self-consistency condition that we will put onto this two-level description, the lineage description and the fitness class description. And in the rest of our framework, well, we're going to sort of take two different views at this problem, I think, than we've traditionally taken. And one thing we're going to do is we're actually going to think about the systems in terms of lineage. So we're never going to think about sites. We're just going to think about lineages. And the idea there is that although if the system is strongly linked, then mutations are not independent. They're correlated, right? Because it's nothing to chop them up. However, fluctuations in the particular mutations are not independent. However, the fluctuations in the frequency of seeing given alleles or lineages is independent, because mutations occur independently and they start new alleles. So this is why we're going to be talking about lineages all throughout.
So K enumerates fitness classes,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Within each fitness class, X is the frequency
of seeing a given allele or lineage. And allele and lineage is the same thing, as far as I'm concerned.
And what's large number of sites within X, the probability, within it affect the frequency of seeing the same?
So we're going to make an assumption that no lineage ever dominates. That's the regime I'm going to go in. So if there's a large number of sites with mutations, then I would actually expect none of the lineage. That's what you're asking about, that there's a large number of sites with mutations, not just generally large number of sites. If there's a large number of sites with many mutations, then I expect none of the lineages to dominate and the distribution to be flat. But the PRF gives us, in steady state, again, what is the distribution that we expect to see.
Did you already explain where that came from? Or
the slide.
Okay,
so for those of you who that are familiar with the PRF, maybe it's best not to listen. So where does the PRF come from? Imagine first of all we have two alleles, an original allele and a derived allele. The derived allele frequency is X and the original is 1 minus X, and the derived one has either a selection advantage or disadvantage, it doesn't matter. So we can write down a diffusion equation, a Fokker-Planck equation for the probability distribution of seeing a derived allele at frequency X at a given time, given it had frequency X naught at time T0. And if we have, this is the forward equation, based on it we can write down the backward equation. So with absorbing boundary conditions at 0 and 1. So this is sort of the standard Fokker-Planckism. And based on that, we can calculate the mean time until absorption. We can also calculate basically the mean first passage time. So if we solve for these times of quantities, we can solve for this quantity, which tells us basically the integrand of the mean first passage time, the mean time an allele spends in a given frequency regime. So the integrand of the mean first passage time. And the PRF is just a generalization of the mean first, of the time an allele spends in a given frequency regime to the case of multiple alleles. With a few assumptions that mutation arise at Poisson times, each mutation forms a new lineage, and that they're independent. So if we do that, then we can say that the frequency of finding an allele in a given, the probability of finding a frequency in an allele in a given frequency window is given by this expression where theta gives us the probability of a new mutation happening and occurring. And this basically tells us, given that a new mutation occurred, how long does it on average live for in that frequency regime has.
What I don't understand is that there are two ways in which sort of a given class can, well, excuse me, given clone mm-hmm. can, given genotype can appear. Right? It can appear through a neutral mutation in BIN-K, or it can appear through a deleterious mutation in BIN-K minus 1.
Yeah.
And at the moment, all the dependence on U neutral is hidden in theta.
Yes.
So somehow it doesn't really matter
how it appears.
So the fact that it can rise in frequency on the, you know, selection SK as opposed to SK minus 1.
No, so
I mean, what you presented on the other slide seems like perfectly fine,
right.
And exact.
But you're worried about my theta definition. Oh, the approximation. Well, there is. So I okay.
So why isn't that just the?
Why isn't
exact?
I think it is exact under
so
this.
Even,
so the even only thing is in the theta you have h. So you need to self-consistently agree your S and your H. That's the only problem.
No, that's just normalization,
yeah.
Eventually. But I'm still missing something. But in your propagator calculation,
yeah.
All the propagation was happening in one bin, right? That was just. There's just one S there, right?
Yeah, because this is F of K. This is F of K.
Precisely. What I'm mumbling is that, but there are two ways of generating this thing. Rising through the K bin and rising through
K minus
K 1. K minus 1 bin and then hopping over.
Yeah, so.
But either way, it has a fitness SK.
Yeah.
Right? You're generating lineages with fitness SK at rate theta K. You just can generate them in two different ways, like you're saying, but regardless of whether, either way, it has the same selection coefficient.
Against the background.
So this theta K.
Okay, that's right, because once it hops over, it
yeah.
still has to rise
yeah.
to frequency X in.
So the assumption, if you will, is just steady state. Which I think, I mean, okay, in thinking about all of this, I actually think the steady state assumption is crucial and at times confusing, because then, you know, and the fact that this has the meaning of a mean of time,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's probability and, you know, time, that's actually important in this, and it wouldn't work if we were not in steady state.
But still a question about assumptions here. So in this, if you go forward one slide, we describe the Poisson field. So here you describe the dynamics within one bin, right,
mm-hmm.
of those fields. And what are the absorbing states here? I mean, are the absorbing states filling completely that one bin, for instance? That would be, I could imagine, one absorbing bin. Or taking over the whole population?
No, filling one thing. You forget about the whole population. The only way you feel your population is through the H's that go into here.
So maybe this is what I'm confused about. You said it somehow, but maybe I didn't get it. So this formula, and of course this whole Poisson random field is when mu times n is small, right? So there's no mu term in your differential equation, and accordingly there's no mu time explicitly in this second factor. So, but on the other hand, for this mutation selection equilibrium, n was infinity. So
n? Oh, mu n. No,
mu time n was large.
Yes. Right?
Because it was a mutation selection equilibrium. And drift was disregarded. So
drift was
How are these consistent?
Okay, I think this is so the self-consistency condition. This might not get, but at least let me go through this, and then we can go back to discussing limits. Okay? So as I said before, we have a self-consistency condition that we have. We want the thing we got from mutation selection to agree with summing up the lineages. So this is what we're looking at. So we can write this down explicitly, and what we find is that this is true if n times the effective selection rate is much larger than 1. So remember that the effective selection rate includes the mutation rate. So if we're close to the mean of the distribution with our fitness, if we're close to the peak, then this condition simply becomes the fact that n times the mutation rate has to be much larger. And it, actually, all that we need is for one of them. If one of the mutation rates dominates, then one of them has to be large. And as Michael just said, the PRF breaks down. The PRF description breaks down anyway if the population size times the mutation rates as small. So all of these conditions basically tell us that the thing I said before is that we are assuming here that no one lineage will ever take over, that we have some distribution of lineages. Now, we are not including drift.
Wait, you are including drift, because your calculation is with a single individual.
Yes. No, right.
And the frequency rises to some finite x. And
that's
why it has to be the fusion equation.
That's why n appears.
Precisely.
Yeah, sorry. The PRF is the solution of the diffusion equation, of course. So does this answer your question?
I'll think about it.
So. Okay. The take-home message is no one lineage ever dominates. If one lineage dominates, we're in deep trouble and none of this works.
I mean, within a fitness class?
Yeah, within a fitness class. I have no winner. Nothing ever fixes.
But the highest fitness class could be very, very small.
Yes.
So this could be a potential problem.
Yes, and this is where we get back to all the questions you keep on asking about. I've always known as Euler's ratchet, so I will continue to ignore them for now. You have one more third time lucky. Okay, so we're all fine now with this description. Lineages, fitness class, we know how to describe the frequency of lineages, so we can move on and try to do something exciting and ask the first question. So the first question we're going to ask is about can we say something about the diversity of this population? And so can we ask some questions about homozygosity, for example? So if I sample two individuals at random from here, what is the probability that they have the same genotype, so that they're exactly the same? If I align them, I can align them exactly. So in order to calculate that, in general, I'm interested in asking the broader question: if I sample n individuals, what's the probability of finding one individuals with allele 1 and 2 with allele 2 and so on. So, but let's start with just two individuals, and what's the probability that they are the same? Well, so I need to calculate the probability that if I choose two, I choose the same one, which the probability of choosing one is just times x times fk of x. I choose 2, it's x squared, and I need to integrate over all frequencies and sum over all fitness classes. And I believe it or not, I can actually do this integral and sum and arrive at something that doesn't look completely horrible. And analogously, I can calculate the probability if I pick 3 individuals, what's the probability that 2 of them are the same and 1 of them is different. And so you probably know where this is going, that this is analogous to the UN sampling formula, which basically asks the same question. If I sample n individuals, what's the probability of having n1 be the same one type, n2 be the same second type, and so on. And the UN sampling formula is UN's derived formula, which is true in the neutral model, and otherwise in basically with the same assumptions that we're looking for. And before I show you how our results compare to this, I'd also like to discuss another important approximation that Stefan mentioned today. Well, he mentioned that I will talk about it, so I am. I have called it here the effective population size approximation. Sometimes it is referred to as a limit of the background selection approximation. Basically, this is an approximation. This is sort of the null model for selection. So imagine you have some population with a given population size, and in the limit of strong selection, where this approximation is valid, you can assume that all that selection does is it effectively reduces the size, the effective population size in this way. So you have deleterious mutations that make you go outside the neutral class, but they're very quickly purged. Well, this is my purging. They're very quickly purged so that things sort of go back to normal. So you have some sort of fluctuation. So effectively, if you look at the system in steady state, you would see an effective population size, that the population size is reduced due to these deleterious mutations that are quickly selected against. And so what this effective population size approximation predicts is that you effectively can think about a system with this strong selection limit as a system, as a neutral system with a reduced population size. Okay, so now to what do we learn about all this? So as I said, we can calculate the homozygosity, and that's what I'm plotting here as a function of the mutation, deleterious mutation rate, UD. This is log scale. And I'm comparing the predictions of our theory with three other neutral models. So I'll discuss these models in a second, but for very low deleterious mutation rates here, we're effectively in the neutral case, right? The deleterious mutation rate is so slow that it seems like zero, and in this case we can further reduce that formula and we get a prediction for the homozygosity, so the probability of picking two individuals that are have the same genotype as 1/ theta, where theta is the population size scaled, well, it's the mutation rate per population, and the UN sampling formula gives us a result of 1/1 plus theta, so in the limit of large theta, which is the limit that our theory is valid from that self-consistency calculation, you see they agree, and these other three lines are neutral models, so everything agrees.
Wait, so what is N in this?
Population size.
Yeah, but what was it, the simulation? S is 10 to the minus 3, and...
So in this we just put in, what did I put in? 10 to the fifth probably? I actually don't remember. But I probably just put in an effective n times s.
Which was large.
Yes, because s is 10 to the minus third and n was say 10 to the fifth, 10 to the sixth.
So selection is strong.
Well, it should be 10 to the 6 because
really?
In the scale to minus 6 equals 24, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yes, thank you.
Okay, so that means you never get polymorphism of any appreciable frequency, right? It's basically your polymorphism spectra are all confined to very small x.
Yes, because this is, if I get anything too large, I'll worry that it starts dominating, especially in the small k classes, and we get back to what Oscar just asked about. that in the, so in the peak of the distribution, even if my, if X's get large, I mean, unless they, it's really hard for an X to dominate in the peak of the fitness distribution. However, at the sites where H of K is small, then it's not that hard for a given lineage to start dominating. So I don't, I want to avoid, I mean, in a way I can never really avoid it, and I'll get to that, but I'm going to be looking in a regime where as I'm going to try and avoid an X ever dominating. That's the self-consistency thing, and this tells us that too. And this will come back and back and back, so this assumption to bite us over and over again. Okay, so as I said, I mentioned this effective population size, where we can write down the theta that way. I just plugged in an effective N scaled by that, and this is going to be this line. And I can think of comparing it to two different forms of the neutral model, where I can write down theta in two different ways. One, so I have to figure out how to compare theta in the presence of deleterious mutations. So the neutral model just gives me theta with neutral mutations, but of course I have deleterious mutations. So I can choose to just ignore the fact that deleterious mutations exist and just count neutral. I can choose to say that deleterious mutations are exactly like neutral. So I'm going to do both.
I'm just saying that they're very different. So I guess I'm still, maybe it's a stupid question. So if the selection is so strong against the mutation rate, so then you just fill the first error class very little, right? Because
yeah,
you have very small x. So how does this together with this whole sequence of, do you have any chance of making a double deleterious mutant, because that's then of order,
yes,
1/S.
No, I have a chance of making a double deleterious mutant because I am in a regime where there's a steady state distribution where the most probable mutant has UD over S mutations. So selection is strong, but it's not very, very strong. It's not, wait one slide. I'll talk about selection. Okay, so in this case, so as Isabel pointed out, these curves are really easy to understand. What we learn is that it's basically the ratio of UD to S that matters. So this is our theory, and as UD becomes of the order of S, the homozygosity starts going down, because that's when deleterious mutations start playing a role. When deleterious mutations are small compared to S, then nothing really matters. When deleterious mutations, the rate of deleterious mutations is large compared to S, then they dominate. And this is when they matter, when they really make a difference. And actually, you can't see, okay? So you can't see. Okay. You can't see a line that goes down here, which is the line that curves. So this basically goes down quicker on the order when UN plus UD. So around, since UN dominates, that's when this neutral model says. So what that comes into, becomes important. So what that tells us is that this, our full theory predicts larger homozygosity than this neutral theory. Is that what I wanted to say? Right. That the homozygosity is decreased less because deleterious mutations deleterious mutations are basically selected upon more than neutral mutations, so they're purged quicker from the population. So this is why this goes down faster. And of course, if we compare to the case where there is where we treat deleterious and neutral mutations the same, then if at some point they stop being the same because again deleterious mutations are purged faster, and then there is a point where this effective population size description would well sort of breaks down and starts to predict that additional deleterious mutations decrease the diversity, that things become more similar, but that's not true. That's simply when we're in a limit where selection becomes larger. So I don't know, I hope this may answer your question. So this is the same thing, homozygosity as a function of this of selection pressure. And so I think the important point to make here is that all three things matter: the rate of neutral mutations, deleterious mutations, and selection. So we have a limit that when neutral, so the neutral mutation rate here and the deleterious mutation rate are comparable, but if selection is larger, then large selection. So mutations are quickly eliminated from the population. So that's where the neutral model holds. For small selection, for small selection, the neutral, the neutral model where neutral and deleterious mutations are treated the same holds, and for strong selection, this model holds. But the point to make is that this region in the middle, where none of the neutral model makes sense. Do you want to talk more about the limits, or did?
Maybe we can use this.
Okay.
So for in a given bean, mm-hmm. I understand if like you ask questions such as what's the probability that two genotypes are the same, if you be. But when you talk about one particular allele, okay, I'm just thinking, given the ancestor, if the L size of the possible like number of allele is large, the larger it is, the probability that the mutation, like different mutations that made you come to this bean, happens is this should decrease.
Right, so what we're assuming is that from the ancestor, every mutation that happens in an ancestor forms a new lineage. So you can't twice mutate into the same thing from a morphid class. The only thing that determines the frequency of a lineage is selection and leaving it. So how fast the clone reproduces.
So L is infinite.
So you can't ever come twice to the same point. That's the model. Okay. This I don't, you can't see anything, so it's a bit disappointing. But all I want to say here is that there's a line on which these dots lie, and that's our prediction. This is a neutral model, and this is the homozygosity, this is bizygosity, and these are results for different UD, this is a function of N, this is a function over UD over S. And the only point I want to make here, this is a comparison of simulations of a Fisher-Wright model, is that our prediction agrees well with simulations for these quantities. And sadly, you can't see that because you can't see the underlying line. So I apologize. But I don't really want to go into it. But so the interesting thing really is that we've sort of seen that the effective population size, that we doesn't limit where, well, neutral theory seems to break down, but maybe we should still be hopeful and maybe we can still find an effective population size that describes everything. So in order to do this, we take a neutral model with the homozygosity sampling result, and based on that we compute an effective theta. Theta includes the effective population size and is proportional to the effective population size. So we calculate it, so we take our predictions, we fit it with this formula, based on that we learn an effective theta, and based with that effective theta we compute higher order statistics. And if we can, by doing this scheme, reproduce these higher order statistics accurately, that means there is an effective population size, we just haven't been smart enough to figure out what it is. So I wouldn't be telling you this if there was one, probably. So there isn't. So this is Q21, so sampling three individuals, two of them the same, one different. Q3, sampling three individuals, all of them the same. And we're comparing the predictions of these way, these statistics computed this way, to actually real values that that we computed. And if it was one, so one is here and one is here, this is as a function of UD, then everything would agree. But you see significant deviations in both cases, and you see that the heterozygosity gets underestimated and this gets overestimated. So this just tells us that there is no effective population size that reproduces these statistics.
So what is the true and what is the approximation?
So this is the so
It's the ratio, okay.
Yeah, it's the ratio.
Yes, all right.
Of the neutral with the best fitted theta to the true. Okay. Okay, so now now to the, I guess, So
that went a little fast. So the bottom line is that it doesn't fit, and presumably the fit gets worse for high order moments. Is that what is something that can be said about the...
Presumably, I would expect that it does, but we haven't checked beyond this, so... But I just would expect it to get worse. So, I mean, there is more to be said here, you know, understanding exactly what goes on, but maybe I should just go on and tell you about the next part of it. So we've now characterized the statistics, but can we say something more about the the relationships among the alleles, and can we say something more about, I mean, the diversity between actual individuals, so that we can try and then relate this to data. So in order to do that, we're going to try and track genealogies. So if we pick two individuals somewhere in the population, can we now track them back? Whoops. This is where they coalesce. Can we now track them back to a common ancestor? So we're going to try and build a coalescence. And we're going to again do it in the same framework. So let me try and walk you through the way we thought about it initially. And so if we pick two individuals in a given lineage, what is the probability that they coalesce? If we pick two individuals in a given fitness class, what is the probability that they coalesce in that fitness class? So in order for them to coalesce in the same fitness class, they have to come from the same lineage. So we just ask, what is the probability of them coming from the same lineage, which is this, and we have to divide by the probability of them being in the same fitness class. OK? Okay, so now if I pick two individuals at random, again from the same fitness class, which I'm calling K, what is the probability that they coalesce in K minus 1? So that means they didn't come from the same lineage, but they were in the same lineage before the last mutation occurred. So that's the way I'm going to think about it. So I'm going to say, what is the probability that a given individual, for example this, came from the previous class when that class was at frequency X, that it mutated. And then that lineage was at frequency X. And then the next individual had to come from this frequency from this lineage when it was at frequency Y. So in the some time, say this occurred at T1 and this occurred at T2, so the lineage frequency had to go between X to Y in time T2 minus T1, so that then this individual could have mutated at T2 when the lineage was at frequency Y. Okay, so this is the frequency, this is the probability of the first individuals coming at T1, probability of the second individual mutating at T2, which means that this lineage had to change in that way. And then I also have to consider the distribution of these times T1 and T2. What is the probability that mutations occurred at time T1 and T2? And if I consider all of that, then that will give me the coalescence probability of these two individuals. This will give me the probability for such an event happening, that at T1 this one mutated, T2 this one mutated, and they mutated from the same lineage, which means that they coalesced. Okay. I'm slightly cheating here, in the sense that I'm not adding the time it took for them then to coalesce in this time. I'm just saying, once I track them back to this lineage, things will happen. So the cheat occurs here, but...
So in some sense, these pairs that you show are an exception, because wouldn't in most cases be only one mutate and stay in the yellow class?
Yes, next slide. Okay, and then if this didn't happen, then I'd need to go one step further and calculate did they coalesce in K minus 2. Okay, so in general, I have to calculate the same thing for the probability that one individual starts in class K, another at K minus M, and they mutate at K minus L in the same way. Okay, so now...
So basically you can describe these genealogies by only the deleterious...
I only have deleterious mutations. Oh, sorry, right. Okay, I didn't say that. So for now, I'm ignoring neutral mutations. I'm only counting deleterious mutations, and then I will... So, okay, the major assumption I'm making here... Thank you, this is actually very useful. So the major assumption I'm making here is that I'm counting time in mutation times. I'm forgetting about real time. And for this reason, I'm not thinking about neutral mutations. I will later say, okay, now that I figured out how to deal with deleterious mutations, I will then take my step times, translate them into real times, and then sprinkle neutral mutations like I would normally do in the coalescence.
But this is not an approximation, right?
No.
You don't have to care about it.
I don't, yeah. So that this, but the so the key is that I'm thinking in step times.
Well, but you could imagine that the lower one derived from the yellow class and the upper one from the red class, and they coalesce within that. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then you would need one neutral, and then three and four in tiers. But I guess I get your point.
Yeah. I think I'll choose to ignore Boris having a nervous breakdown.
But I mean, the coalescence times in your problem are completely independent of whether you have neutral mutations or not.
Yes.
Neutral mutations are just dressing the individuals in the offspring, just labeling them, but they don't change the coalescence times.
Whatsoever. Okay, I will. No? Okay. Well, so then I have this expression that we've agreed upon, and I have to, you know, I can't just leave it here and walk away, so I have to calculate it. I will first notice a great simplification that I have this y integral here with this horrible Gegenbauer in it, but I will notice that this is the only y integral that comes in here. So essentially, I can do that because I know this is just the mean of how the frequency in that given lineage changes. So I know how, on average, the average frequency, which is what this thing tells me, changes. It changes exponentially. And so I can do that integral and make things easier. This is sort of a small technical point. And now back to Michael's point. At what I think Michael was hinting, that I have to deal with these times. So I have to calculate the times. Let me just pull this up. I have to calculate the times at which these the two mutations happened. And I'm going to make an approximation, which we call the non-conditional approximation, that I'm going to say that the distribution of the mutant timings is independent. So this is in principle not true, because if I'm going back in time, say I want to coalesce in k-2. I go from k to k-1 with individual A, and I go to k-1 with individual B, and then they could coalesce. In principle, I could have ended up in the same lineage, but I didn't, because I'm assuming I didn't. So in these timings, I have to take into account the probability that they did not coalesce until I got to k-2. Because then the way I calculate these timings are just by saying that, how the timings of mutations evolve by, you know, because I know that things can either coalesce or, because I know that the probability of seeing a mutation decreases with the exponential of the selection rate. So, but I'm assuming all of this is independent. Okay. And then I need to evaluate many integrals, and if I do that, then I end up with a rather nicely looking formula, at least compared to this, for the probability in the non-conditional approximation for the two individuals to coalesce. And so I'll discuss this, what this means, in great detail. I'd just like to point out that this is a coefficient that only depends on the classes in which the mutants started and in which they coalesced. And this coefficient actually comes from doing all these time integrals. So it basically scales the probability of coalescence result by how likely things are to coalesce as you go back in time, depending on where you started. Yes.
So my puzzlement has been maybe having to do with this approximation that you just described. Is that kind of expected that you'll end up, it's not a transfer matrix, but some sort of nested set of equations which would basically force you to calculate the probability that they coalesce in the previous bin, or...
Yes. And I would.
One minus the probability. Yes. Okay.
Exactly. If I didn't make this approximation, I would have exactly what you're talking about. But we looked at that, we went back two or three steps, and it's nested, it's ugly, we saw no pattern. Okay. You can, in principle, do it.
Okay.
So we know how to do it, it just didn't seem like a worthwhile thing. Okay, so what does this result mean? So first of all, let me describe the dependence on the parameters. So what I'm plotting here is this coalescence probability as a function of L, starting from some class K. So this is the class they start of, and this is the most fit class. So you see that this is for different values of N times S. So you see that the coalescence probability is inversely proportional both to N and S. So it decreases both with population size and with selection. And you see, so these two graphs show two cases. One distribution, which is sampled just to the right, where they start off, this is starting from the same fitness class. And here I'm assuming they'll start off with a fitness class to the right of the mean. So they're more fit than the mean. And here I'm assuming they start off in a fitness class to the left of the mean. And you see that the most likely to coalesce in the most populated class. And least likely to coalesce in the most populated class, because that's where the diversity is largest. And then the most likely to coalesce right at the beginning. So this H, the inverse proportionality to the distribution, tells you that. So, but we can understand this with in even more detail by seeing that we have this S times K, so the effective selection coefficient, which we can call SK, and we have the effective population size, which we call NK. So we see that the coalescence probability is inversely proportional to the effective population size and the effective selection coefficient. And we know that each lineage spends an average of 1 over SK generations in each fitness class. So the coalescence probability, so the per generation, so what this tells us is that the per generation coalescence probability is basically inversely proportional to the occupation of an effective of the effective population size in a given class, scaled by these timings. So think of the A's as timings. Okay, but also this tells us that we have, so the coalescence probability basically depends on a historically varying population size. And so in these two cases, this is the less fit, so here, less fit than here, we have an historically dependent population size that looks like this. So the population size first would increase and then decrease. If we start here, then we just see a sort of simple dependence on the historically dependent decreasing population size. So if we got data like this, we could say, okay, the population size just decreased. We wouldn't be able to really infer selection here. But here we just see a funky effective population size. So that would probably tell us that something's going on. So this is a signature, another signature of selection that we see. And of course, this gets, if you pick two individuals from two population sizes, you would have an even stranger dependence of this effective population size. Okay, but still, I'm not quite the data. At the level of comparing to data, and that's what I'd like to get to. So once the statistic that we can think of is to look at the per site heterozygosity, so pi, which basically if I pick two individuals, I can ask how different are they. So if I count the number of mutations that are different between them, so for these, it would be basically 1, 2, 3, 4. I can ask about the distribution of in a population of the per site heterozygosity. So, okay, all this is, as I said, try to say here, is the distance in the number of mutations between individual A and individual B. So I have to figure out where they coalesced and then count things. And again, I'm counting everything in step time, so I really just have to count. So in order to do that, so what is the probability that the to A and B differ by four mutations? So this means the tree has to look like that. And so this means that they did not coalesce in class K. They did not coalesce in class K minus one, but they did coalesce in class K minus two. And I can write down an analogous expression to that for them starting from A and B starting from different classes. I have to be careful about the counting. And then to get the distribution of the heterozygosity, I have to average over the probability of finding an individual in a given fitness class, which I know because I'm in steady state, I have this HK distribution.
Yeah.
I'm a bit pressed for time. Okay. Okay, I have two more points to make. So one point that I'll try and make really quickly is that, so think back to this. So now we can plot the mean distribution of pi d as a function of ud over s and as a function of n times s, and we start to notice that for large n times s, the mean distribution of pi d levels off. And it levels off at the value which is 2 times ud over s. And this is a regime, so we've identified this regime, and I think I'm still debating what to call it right now. So I called it the mean coalescence path approximation for the purpose of this talk. And this is a regime which is very similar to this effective population size regime. Remember where we assumed that all coalescence happened in the zero class, but that was because things hardly ever left the zero class. So here we will assume something similar, that all coalescence happens in the zero class, and that's what we saw in the PC plots. Remember that coalescence was most likely in zero, but we will assume that the time, the coalescence time, is dominated by the time it takes to get to the zero class, so the time to go through the distribution. And since most individuals are in the most likely class up here, which is ud over s, so the mean of pi d is simply 2 times ud over s. Okay, so this is a regime, and so this is why we see no dependence. And I think we're excited about this regime because it seems to come, a lot of results can be simply explained by thinking about the problem that way. So the means of the distribution, and actually we can also get an expression for the form of the distribution of pi d in this regime. Okay. And so the last thing is what Stefan already noticed, is the comparison, you know, how do we add up, how do we add in neutral mutations. So to add in neutral mutations, we now need to take and translate translate our probability to coalesce so many step times ago into actually the distribution of timings of coalescence events. And so we can do that by figuring out what is the distribution of coalescence times conditional, on them having coalesced specifically in that point, and then multiply that by the distribution. And to calculate this, we have to convolute the time, the mutation times, with the time to coalesce in a given class K minus L. And we're actually, again, in plotting these results, we're going to assume that the coalescence, once they're in the same class, that is negligible. Okay. So once we figured out the distribution of timings, then we can do what you typically do in a normal coalescence, is you know that neutral mutations are Poisson distributed, but weighted by these timings, which we figured out, so we can calculate that, And similarly to the neutral coalescence, where the timings are exponentially distributed and you expect an exponential decay with a peak at zero, also in our case, the probability of seeing a given distribution of neutral mutations is dominated by the timings. But our timings now, remember, are really dominated by UD over S, because that's where our coalescence probabilities were dominated by. So we see a peak, a non-zero peak, and we don't see an exponential distribution of neutral mutations. And so this is these are two clear signatures that can be directly compared with data. Okay, so that's it. And I won't conclude in the interest of time, but I guess the exciting thing in a way is this simple regime in which we hope to calculate more statistics, like higher order diversity statistics and things like that, which we're actually doing right now. So, okay.
Couldn't one also compare your approach to a thing called structured coalescence? Yes. Because in principle, what we have here is a number of sort of beams, subpopulations that have a stable, totally fixed population size, and they're connected by migrations. Uh-huh. And this has been analyzed, I mean, this is a generalization of the coalescence. If you follow, go back in time and just think about how lineages jump from one beam to another one according to the migration matrix. Here it's a mutation rate. Should give you all those results in principle.
So, okay, one thing I actually forgot to say because I took out the slide, but we realized that our result can be directly compared to a lot of things that have been done before. So one thing is a paper by Isabel and Brian Charlesworth, where they basically built up a scheme which is exactly equivalent to what we do by asking, so by saying at each moment you have to compare the probability of coalescing with the probability of mutating. So you have a weight for each. And so you can calculate the probability of the first event to be a coalescence based on just sort of a partition function based on that. And then you can trace this back and calculate all possible paths, and you get exactly the same result we got. So we realized this after the gore of what we did. And we're also realizing that you can obtain this result in a few different ways. I haven't actually thought about migration matrices, so maybe we...
It's called the structured coalescence.
This is exactly a structured coalescence.
Yeah.
That's explicitly what it is. But I
except
think,
for thinking about these subclasses within fields.
Right, but I mean, that's just a detail. I mean, it is basically exactly a structured coalescence. But I think that...
I mean, I think your approach was exactly the structured coalescence. So
Norbert called that limit the strong migration limit.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so here it is.
But I don't think anybody has had sort of explicit formulas for what the coalescent probabilities are.
Yeah, that is correct. I guess